say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here.
Oh, I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Simone with I Shall Be Released, a classic written by Bob Dylan way back in 1967. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Thursday, June the 25th, 2015, and President Obama is celebrating a legal victory over a Republican challenge to the Affordable Care Act. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today in a 6-3 decision that the Affordable Care Act's insurance subsidies, even in states that did not offer them, are constitutional. Obama declared at a news conference in the Rose Garden earlier this morning that the ACA is here to stay, but Republicans are vowing to continue the fight to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court decision, you should know, does not at all affect further legislative action in the Congress, and there's where the Republicans have said they will continue the fight to repeal it. Well, we go back to Sister Hillary today, following yesterday's speech. Sister Hillary preaching the word, and of course, as we will find out, practically nothing is sacred. The June 17th massacre of 9 members of the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, by a white, self-avowed white supremacist gunman, provided Democratic presidential contender Hillary Clinton the perfect opportunity to go stomping for black votes. She was not about to let the crisis go to waste. Clinton on Tuesday appeared at Christ the King United Church of Christ in Florissant, Missouri, literally just a few miles, 3.4 miles away from where Michael Brown was killed last year in August. And to enthusiastic applause, she laid out her political vision and agenda for African Americans. The speech was meant to convey her deep understanding of the issues affecting African Americans and her connection with this constituency, a connection that is touted as quite unique. But as we will discover today, the address actually confirms her own racism. It's the liberal brand of racism, but it's racism, and we will find it. The distorted view that she has of people of color and her own sense of entitlement. So we will take the speech apart, and we will stop at very interesting points, and we will analyze. So let's get started with the first chunk of the speech.
How do we make sense of such an evil act? An act of racist terrorism perpetrated in a house of God. How do we turn grief, anger, and despair into purpose and action? Those of us who are Christians are challenged by Jesus Christ to forgive 70 times 7, a daunting, even impossible task for most of us. But then we have seen that scriptural admonition in action. Isn't it amazing, remarkable even, when fear, doubt, desire for revenge might have been expected, but instead forgiveness is found? Although a fundamental part of our doctrine, its practice is the most difficult thing we are ever called to do. But that's what we saw on Friday, when one by one, grieving parents, siblings, and other family members looked at that young man who had taken so much from them and said, "I forgive you." Wanda Simmons, the granddaughter of Reverend Daniel Simmons, said, "Although my grandfather and the other victims died at the hands of hate, this is proof. Everyone's plea for your soul," she said to the killer, "is proof that they lived in love. So hate won't win." Their act of mercy was as stunning as his act of cruelty. Hate cannot win. There is no future without forgiveness, Archbishop Desmond Tutu taught us. And forgiveness is the first step toward victory in any journey.
Okay. First of all, we have to appreciate the familiarity with the Bible and of Hillary Rodham Clinton, a great familiarity with the Bible. She quotes it. So she's established herself as a Christian candidate. I hope you're taking note of all of this. This was not part of her discourse in her political life, but it is part of the discourse. She's one. She's at one with the Christian world. But look at what she says. That what was remarkable here was that the congregation forgave. Well, one or two or three or four, maybe the whole congregation forgave. But what she is actually saying, and she brings in Desmond Tutu, the Archbishop in South Africa, good old Desmond. She uses him to illustrate a point that forgiveness is a requirement for progress. You understand this? Forgiveness is, without forgiveness, there's no need, there's no way to move forward. So it is a requirement. The implication here is, suck it up, you noble sufferers, you people who deal with tragedy so well. Just suck it up one more time. And we also should pay attention to the choice of words here. That there is mercy on one hand, and yet there is hate on the other hand. This is not just hate. You see, the simplification of the whole thing has already occurred. She has transformed it. This massacre, which also involves an assassination, because the pastor was an elected official. He was a member of the state senate. So we have a massacre, a mass murder, and we have an assassination. But she reduces this to hate. And the overwhelming love of these passive noble suffering people, the capacity to forgive should be even greater at this time, she says, because according to Desmond Tutu, and if he says it, this is the way it is, you know, the condescending nature of it. You reach all the way there. Look, this is what this black guy said. So it's got to be true. It's got to be relevant to you and your situation. He says forgiveness is required. So if you're one of those people who still have a hard edge, you are an impediment to progress. This is how you understand how this so-called liberal / progressive, as she's being touted, you see the immediate identification with all of the trappings of the very thing she says she's confronting, which is racism. All right. So she sets the tone. Forgive so that we can move on. Let's hear what she has to say next.
I know it's tempting to dismiss a tragedy like this as an isolated incident, to believe that in today's America, bigotry is largely behind us, that institutionalized racism no longer exists. But despite our best efforts and our highest hopes, America's long struggle with race is far from finished. We can't hide from hard truths about race and justice. We have to name them and own them and change them. That's why I appreciate the actions begun yesterday by the governor and other leaders of South Carolina to remove the Confederate battle flag from the State House. Recognizing it as a symbol of our nation's racist past that has no place in our present or our future. It shouldn't fly there. It shouldn't fly anywhere. And I also commend Walmart for deciding to remove any product that uses it. Today, Amazon, eBay, and Sears have followed suit, and I urge all sellers to do the very same.
Well, this is quite enlightening for a number of reasons. Again, the revisionism and the use of words, how words are changed in order to dilute the impact, even as she's trying to communicate. I understand this, but she is not willing to go full force against white supremacy. So it becomes bigotry. It was hate in the first segment. It is now bigotry. It doesn't have that systemic political meaning. It's bigotry. It's kind of individualistic, and it becomes institutionalized racism, a very nice big amorphous word, a concept. It's a big thing, but she's not saying what it is, and yet she is indicating that she actually is saying what it is. She talks about America's long struggle with race. America has not had a long struggle with race. Oppressed people in America have had a long struggle with race. White supremacists have not had a long struggle with race. They're the ones who designed the system, and it was not a struggle. Every now and then, they had to kind of contain the enthusiasm for liberation and for freedom. but they always had at their disposal all the mechanisms of control. So they didn't have to struggle with race. She gives this impression that we're all in this together. We were all struggling, trying to find our way with each other. A distortion of the historical reality. We cannot hide, she says, from race and justice. Again, who is this we you're talking about? Who are the we you're talking about? Was all of America involved in this forward movement toward progress and equality and freedom? No. We're real clear about that. But she rewrites history right there. And they're applauding because they are not listening. That they actually are being insulted by someone who comes in their midst and distorts their reality. And then, of course, the whole thing about the Confederate flag. Of course, this was greeted with great enthusiasm. Remove the Confederate flag, as Walmart has. This woman is irredeemable. Walmart happens to be the international conglomerate whose board she sat on. She was a member of its board from 1986 to 1992. And in all of that time, had no problem with Walmart selling the Confederate flag. Nor did she have problems with Walmart's inequitable pay scales, or its treatment of women, or its treatment of employees of color. Had no problems with any of that. But she astutely says, first and foremost, she still is locked in to her allegiance to corporate America. Walmart is still a very important connection for her. So she mentions the Confederate flag only to congratulate Walmart for removing it from its shelves. In other words, I am sending, she's using this horrible situation, this terrible, terrible massacre and assassination. In the speech, she does not deviate from her purpose. And the purpose is to say, Walmart, I am no longer physically on the board because, you know, political issues have arisen that make it difficult for me to physically maintain a presence on your board. But you know I'm with you. I'm still with you. So I give you deference. I give you deference. By the way, ABC News in, I believe, 2008, carried a story. This was when Hillary Clinton was running. And it said that an ABC News analysis of the videotapes of at least four stockholder meetings where Clinton appeared shows she never once rose to defend the role of American labor unions. That's ABC News, 2008. A former board member told ABCNews.com that he had no recollection of Clinton defending unions during more than 20 board meetings held in private. The tapes show Clinton in the role of a loyal company woman. Quote, I'm always proud of Walmart and what we do and the way we do it better than anybody else. Quote, she said at a June 1990 stockholders meeting. So even now, although for political reasons she had to make her exit from the board, she's still Walmart. People need to note this. Well, let's go on to the next chunk of Sister Hillary preaching to black folks.
But you know, and I know, that's just the beginning of what we have to do. The truth is, equality, opportunity, civil rights in America are still far from where they need to be. Our schools are still segregated, in fact, more segregated than they were in the 1960s. Nearly 6 million young Americans between the ages of 16 and 24 are out of school and out of work. Think of that, neither learning nor working. And the numbers are particularly high for young people of color. Statistics like these are rebukes to the real progress we have made, and they pose an urgent call for us to act publicly, politically, and personally. We should start by giving all of our children the tools and opportunities to overcome legacies of discrimination, to live up to their own God-given potentials. I just saw some of the young people attending camp here at the church down in the basement, and I was thrilled to see that because that is the kind of commitment we need more of in every church, in every place, until every child is reached. And I hope we can take that as a cause for action.
There's some more from Hillary Clinton. Do you know that she actually thinks that she is educating the community about the importance of education? She actually thinks that she's doing that. She actually believes that she is telling a group of black people in 2015, educating them about the importance of education, which is one thing, but about the dismal state of affairs with respect to education, all completely based on the very thing she says, well, it's kind of tough. We have a really rough time with race. We always talk about this we, what we have. No, we don't have it. And she goes on to illustrate the point, which is well documented and has been documented that way for decades. I mean, my goodness. We've had Supreme Court cases going back to the 1950s, Brown versus Board of Ed. But even before that, these people should know that the very first petition before Congress after the alleged abolition of slavery was about education. The very first things that the enslaved Africans did in this country was to pool their money and set up schools. Nobody has to tell black people about the importance of education. They know that. But she has very little to say about the root causes of it. She understands the statistics, and she's telling people, this is how bad your situation is. Well, how did it come to be so? She's not there to explain that. No, but I want you to pay attention to the topics that she highlights as part of her political awareness, and of course, we are to assume part of her political agenda to address. So on the top of the list, she's talking about, you got bad schools. They've been bad for a long time. Your children are dropping out. And that's been known for a long time. Let's listen to some more of the hot topics that Sister Hillary is preaching about.
I learned this not from politics, but from my mother, who taught me that everybody needs a chance and a champion. She knew what it was like to have neither one. Her own parents abandoned her. By 14, she was out on her own working as a housemaid. Years later, when I was old enough to understand, I asked her, "What kept you going?" Her answer was very simple. Kindness along the way from someone who believed she mattered. All lives matter. And for her, it was the first grade teacher who saw she had nothing to eat at lunch and, without embarrassing her, brought extra food to share. It was the woman whose house she cleaned who agreed to let her go to high school so long as her work got done. Because those people believed in her, gave her a chance, she believed in me. And she taught me to believe in the potential of every American. That inspired me to go to work for the Children's Defense Fund after law school. It inspired me to work for the Legal Services Corporation, where I defended the rights of poor people to have lawyers. I saw lives changed because an abusive marriage ended or an illegal eviction stopped. In Arkansas, at the law school there, I supervised law students who represented clients in courts and prisons, organized college scholarship funds for single parents, led efforts for better schools and better health care. So I know what personal kindness, political commitments, and public programs can do to help those who are trying their best to get ahead. That's why we need to build.
Okay. So what we have here is now a shift. This is where Hillary Clinton absolutely connects with the souls before her. And she connects because, hey, we've got a lot in common. Everybody needs a chance and a champion. Well, that's not a bad slogan. But what it is that it is redolent of the nature of the power equation generally seen between white America and black America. You can't get that yourself. And you can therefore look to me as your patron saint. I am the one to bring you your redemption. You can't achieve this on your own. Everybody needs a chance and a champion. Well, yeah, well, that's called human rights. Everybody is in need of an opportunity to just do their thing. That's what supposedly is part of this democratic ideal. You don't have to wait for anybody to give you anything. But she comes there and she's telling them, I recognize that this is the nature of our relationship between white America and black America. You are to be given things. And we, white America, we are the ones who will decide whether to give them to you. All lives matter. Isn't that a revelation? And then she talks about her mother, the housemaid. Now, you see how these things were? Well, of course, you of black people, you know what I'm talking about. A whole bunch of you and your mothers were housemaids. But of course, she's saying, well, that was my mother. My mother was a housemaid. And so I understand your pain because I'm probably looking at a whole bunch of housemaids right now. How she had nothing to eat at lunch. Why is she saying that? Because she is talking to black people and she assumes that their children have nothing to eat at lunch. They black, they poor. Therefore, you understand what I'm doing. You understand what I'm talking about. and how the mother got to go to school as long as she got her work done. You know, these are the kinds of refrains that harken back to that era and that mentality of supremacy, of racism. And she is using all of these stereotypical assumptions in addressing a group of people who probably have had nobody working as maids in their family. She says that these are the things that inspired her to go on and excel in her own life. And then we get a taste from Hillary's own head as to how important she was, how many good things she has achieved. Because her mother, who, like a black woman, was a maid, invested in her and became her champion. And because of that, because of kindness along the way, because that's what is largely viewed for black people, your life depends on the kindness of strangers. You have no power on your own to define your own destiny, let alone go ahead and live your life. It is accepted. She is talking to a group of very powerless people, and she is the power. And she is the power because she is made of tough stuff, and she has excelled. And what was the work that she took the time to point out that she did? What were these achievements? In what areas? She helped people get out of abusive marriages. Hello. You know she's talking to black folks. I know you beat up your wives. But these are the things that I went on to do because I was so dedicated to people like you. To you people. I helped people get out of their abusive marriages. I helped stop illegal evictions. Because I know you understand that. This is part of your daily experience. You get evicted every day. You understand now why you can look to me as your savior, as your deliverer. I helped provide public defense to, you know, your sons and your husbands who are in jail. That's what I did. For you people, I did these things to help even single parents. All these racist, stereotypical things are in there. You don't see it. You're not hearing it until you take the time to listen. This is a racist woman. And she's there talking to a group of people who are not paying attention. All these things I have done for you people, her success is predicated on black folks. That's really what she's saying. That's exactly what she's saying. And she goes back to her early days. She ain't talking about anything recent. She's going back to the early days because these are the things that she needs to highlight, all these wonderful things that she's done for you ungrateful people. You ought to be grateful that she did these things. Let's have some more Hillary, shall we?
Build an economy for tomorrow, not yesterday. You don't have to look far from this sanctuary to see why that need is so urgent. But you also don't have to look far to see that talent and potential is all right here if only we unleash it. I believe that talent is universal, but opportunity is not. We need to rebuild the American Opportunity Society for the 21st century. And you might ask, how do we do that? Well, first start looking at the faces and the energy of the young people I just saw downstairs. We have to start early. Make sure every four-year-old in America has access to high-quality preschool. Because those early years are when young brains develop, and the right foundation can lead to lifelong success. Now, I'm not saying this just because I'm now a grandmother of the most amazing, brilliant, extraordinary 9-month-old in the history of the world. I'm saying this because, again, I know what the evidence is. I know that 80% of your brain is developed by the age of 3. So we have to do more. And when I say we, I mean churches and houses of worship. I mean businesses. I mean charities. I mean local governments. All of us have to do more to help families be their child's first teachers from 0 to 5. You know, when I was First Lady of Arkansas, I struggled with this issue. We had a lot of kids, poor kids, in the Delta and South Arkansas and up in the mountains. And we were not going to be able to afford at that point, all those years ago, a universal pre-K program. We had to do more, but we were never going to do enough. So I looked for programs that people could run themselves. And I found a program in Israel, a program designed to help the children of immigrants into Israel, particularly from Ethiopia, who came with their parents seeking religious freedom. They were Ethiopian Jews. They had to escape, but many of them had never been to school. And the secret to the program, called the Home Instruction Program for Preschool Youngsters, was to teach the mother to teach her child. We need to do more of that, and I call on all of us to find ways to reach into those families. And then as our kids grow up, they're going to need not only a good education to prepare them, but the skills for tomorrow's jobs. We need tax credits for businesses that invest in apprenticeships, particularly providing opportunities to economically disadvantaged young people. In order to create those new jobs, we have to attract investment into communities too often ignored or written off. Whether you live in Ferguson or West Baltimore, in coal country or Indian country, you should have the same chance as any American anywhere to get ahead and stay ahead. We should reauthorize the New Markets Tax Credit, which has encouraged billions of dollars in private funding for community development and small businesses in low-income, low-investment areas. It should be permanent. A lot of new jobs are going to come from small businesses, and we know that women and people of color face extra hurdles becoming entrepreneurs. It's harder to find the support networks. It's harder to get that loan. So we've got to do more to knock down the barriers so every good idea that anybody has will get a fair hearing and a chance to create a new business, to employ people and raise their incomes. We must do all we can to be sure our communities respect law enforcement and that law enforcement respects the communities they serve. And we need to come together for common sense gun reforms that keep our communities safe.
Sister Hillary is on a roll. Yes, indeed. She's spelling out all the things that need to happen so that Black people can progress. Yes, indeedy. First of all, she again assumes she's educating people about what it takes to raise a bright child. You know, one like her granddaughter. You got to start early. Now, this is a woman who just said about, you know, the state of education in the country is so poor, so segregated, and all of that. Of course, she's saying these things fully cognizant of the fact that all of the negatives that apply to the people that she's talking to do not apply and will not apply to her granddaughter. Her granddaughter doesn't have to worry about any of this because her granddaughter is a beneficiary of a system that she knows very well will afford opportunities, which is the word she's been using a lot in this speech, afford her granddaughter opportunities that none of these people that she's talking to, none of their children or grandchildren will have. She knows that. And I'm talking about the insult here is that the people she is talking to do not recognize the fact that they're being insulted. And they don't recognize this fact because they're disconnected from their history and disconnected from their own reality. You presume to educate black people about the importance of education in this country? Then you must have been in a coma most of your life. We have documented proof going all the way before even the nation became a nation, with slaves investing in education. We also have a documented history of this country making it a capital offense to read and write. Where have you been? Where have you been that you don't know this? That education was so important that they literally sacrificed their lives and risked their lives for it. We have somebody, a total opportunist, thinking that she's doing you a grand favor to come and preach to you in your own church and using racist paradigms, and you're there applauding because your brains are addled and you tolerate this insult. But you know, there are paradigms that might be useful that can teach you how to teach your children. And where is a great paradigm to be found? The one she found in Israel. You go study how Israel delivered quality education to Ethiopian Jews. Look, you know, this thing gets to be so sick. You can't imagine that these things are happening in literally in broad daylight. In 2015. And these people are sitting there allowing themselves to be so humiliated by this inveterate liar. And she comes there to tell you, and she's telling you, look, I know that you're in bad shape, but my granddaughter, the greatest person on the planet, essentially, my granddaughter is going to be assured a very, very different kind of life from the one that I'm talking to you about now, which is the kind of life you have. And this is a so-called liberal, progressive person talking. And she's laid out her program, which includes, you've got to respect the police. You got to respect the police. And the police, of course, will then respect you. She's chiding these people. All the things they have to do. She has not, up until this point, addressed really what she is willing to do or what her program is exactly for confronting the vestiges of the what I have been talking about from the 13th Amendment, the badges of slavery. She has revised history, she has ignored history, and she is playing by the same white supremacist rules. It has a nice softer touch, a kind of marshmallowy nature. It's soft and cushy, but it is white. In the political sense that we've been discussing, just the same. You ought to go to Israel and adopt them and see how they educate their children. You must be out of your mind. You've got to be out of your mind. And the people tolerating this are even more so out of their minds. But still, we see that the intention here, all of this talking that Hillary is talking, she is just right outside of Ferguson. She never did get there when things were hot. She never made a statement about Ferguson. She never talked about justice and equality and opportunity and education. And Michael Brown was on his way to college. Yeah, talking about that. That is not important. But let's have Hillary now give the homework assignment. Sister Hillary giving homework assignment.
Key to all of this is revitalizing our democracy and finally persuading the 50 million Americans who do not vote that by not voting, they make it possible for people who do not agree with them, do not support their aspirations, to call the shots. Earlier this month, I went to Texas Southern University to speak out against systematic efforts to disempower and disenfranchise young people, poor people, people of color, and the elderly. We need early voting in every state and automatic universal voter registration. I think every young American, when they turn 18, should be universally, automatically registered unless they say no. Now, if we restitch the fraying fabric of our communities, we will only do so if all Americans do their part. I grew up in the Methodist Church. My mother taught Sunday school and made sure, part of the reason she taught Sunday school is to keep an eye on my brothers, who were supposed to be in Sunday school, but you never knew. So she was there to make sure that they showed up in their classes. But she also made sure we heard the wisdom of John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, to do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. And that meant more than prayer. It meant we had to step out of the church, roll up our sleeves, and get to work. I was blessed with a wonderful youth minister who took some of us into Chicago to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak. Now, I grew up in an all-white, middle-class suburb. I didn't have a black friend, neighbor, or classmate until I went to college. And I am so blessed to have had so many in my life since. But I leapt at the chance to hear Dr. King's words. The sermon that evening was titled, Remaining Awake Through a Revolution. Dr. King challenged us to stay engaged in the cause of justice, not to slumber while the world changed around us. I think that's good advice for all of us today. We should all commit to stay awake and stay active, to do our part in our families, our businesses, unions, houses of worship, schools, and yes, in the voting booth. Never stop working for a stronger, more prosperous, more just, more inclusive America. Government has a big part of the responsibility to promote growth, fairness, and justice. But so do all of us. So in quiet moments in the days ahead, in honest conversations, let's talk about what each of us can and should do. Because ultimately, this is really all about the habits of our hearts, how we treat each other, how we learn to see the humanity in those around us, and how we teach our children to see that humanity too. And we don't have to look far for examples. Those 9 righteous men and women who invited a stranger into their midst to study the Bible with them, someone who did not look like them, someone they had never seen before. Their example and their memory show us the way. Their families, their church does as well. So let us be resolved to make sure they did not die in vain. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Thank you, and God bless you.
And thank you. Thank you, Reverend Hillary. Well, what did she do? She started with Desmond Tutu. She ended with Martin Luther King, and all to prove that she's familiar with the philosophy of the black folks and the good things that they said. And Martin Luther King reminded us to remain awake during the revolution. Okay. We had a whole lot of the black people, the ones who are oppressed, the Latinos. Every oppressed community has a long list of people who told them the same thing, going all the way back. We know that. The fact is that there is no revolution. And there is no revolution because your system of white supremacy has been very effective. And we have people who have fallen down on the job. All those people applauding, the insults being hurled at them, and the revisionism of their history, those people have gone to sleep. That's the revolution. We all have a part to play, she says, to create a just America. No, we don't all have a part to play at all. The record shows that people did more than enough to register their concern about an unjust America. And met, including Martin Luther King, assassinated, and most recently, Reverend Pinckney, assassinated because he wanted a more just America. So to stand up there and tell people about we all have a role, no, this is your mess. You clean it up. This is what you created. This is what your system created. You fix it. The only job that people have who consider themselves part of an oppressed group, their only job is to see to their survival and the judicious use of their time. When, after the benefit of time and doubt, the statistics show not only a resistance to an effort to humanize the society, and that's what all of the black struggles have been about, humanizing the society. Native Americans, that's what all their struggles have been about, humanizing the society. There comes a time when you have to say that the more judicious use of your time is putting together systems that will pull you through and the generations coming after you as well. That's your job. Your job is not to fix this. This is not going to be fixed. You can fix you, and you can fix a system that deals with your unique needs. The psychotic system suits them just fine. They organized it just fine. And that is why Hillary Clinton could stand up. And we haven't even touched her political history here. We're just dealing specifically with the speech and what she conveys and the alternate reality that she is preaching to people who are so disconnected from their reality that they are accepting this with great enthusiasm and without objection. And now the final blow in revisionism, she says, how do we fix this? We have to fix it so that in the way that we can all treat each other with humanity. And that is her explanation of how you undo white supremacy. Because, you see, it's really about bad manners. It's about individuals being really evil, she says. If only we can learn how to treat each other right. An infantile, stupid analysis. Then we would have a better life. And we would have achieved the ultimate goal of freedom and justice and equality. But in the meantime, bring those souls to the polls. Register to vote because, and she blames them too. When you don't vote, you get what you get. And yay! Well, that brings us to the end of our little program today. I hope it opened your eyes and caused you to revisit this issue about whether we intend to wake up and deal with the reality that we are in. Do we yet see ourselves getting closer to clarity of our reality? I don't know. But I want to provoke you into doing just that. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Great program. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how these things are resonating with you, what you're thinking about these programs. Leadstories@gmail.com. I do really appreciate connecting with you. I consider it a great honor and privilege to be in your esteemed company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
He understands a man in this lonely crowd. Man who says he's not to blame.